Lake Effect brings you conversations about what's happening in Milwaukee and the people, places, and organizations that shape the community. This is Lake Effect Spotlight from WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
This week, Lake Effect is taking a step back to explore Milwaukee and Wisconsin's immigration history through our series, Making Wisconsin. The goal of this series is to help us understand who our neighbors are and how immigration has shaped our city, state, and country. Today, we're exploring the concept of sanctuary, which has a few definitions. It's a physical space within a house of worship, but it's also been thought of as a safe harbor where immigrants and refugees can seek respite. Throughout our local and national history, there have been waves of sanctuary movements stemming from religious organizations, activists, and legislation. To help us take a look at sanctuary and how it shaped our history and politics today, I'm joined by Marquette University Assistant Professor of History and author Sergio Gonzalez. Gonzalez begins by explaining how sanctuary is defined and uniquely remembered in relation to American history.
In U.S. immigration history, people have often defined the United States as a place of sanctuary for people all across the world, refugees, asylum seekers, economic migrants, people who are looking for a new opportunity or a sense of safety here in this country. When we think even more specifically, and I think if we think of the 21st century in 2025, sanctuary now has a very specific political connotation. And of course, that's very much connected to the question of immigration and the way in which immigration activists have taken up that term, especially since the 1980s, as a rallying cry. To really create these spaces of safety for undocumented immigrants and refugees in this country.
So we're going to kind of wind the scope back and kind of go through a little chronological history, especially here in Wisconsin, but also the U.S., about sanctuary. So to localize it here, shall we start with the Underground Railroad in Wisconsin? And was this kind of one of our first big public moments of sanctuary?
Yeah, absolutely. If we think about sanctuary as this kind of founding mythology of the United States, that the U.S. has always been that way, different groups throughout American history have appropriated that language to their own ends. And I think one of the most dramatic examples is in the 19th century. Abolitionists who strongly objected to the institution of slavery, but didn't just object to it in their language and their ideas or even in what they wrote, but they actually enacted it through the material work that they did, which is to say that they created movements to try to help enslaved people flee indentured and servitude and move towards the north, either to northern states that did not have enslavement or maybe crossing over into the Canadian border. And so I'm sure that a lot of listeners are familiar with the Underground Railroad. They learned about it in elementary school, but people might not know that Wisconsin had these important stops all across the southeastern parts of the state that served in the 1850s all the way up until the early 1860s as important locations for people who were coming up from Missouri through Illinois, making their way through Wisconsin, eventually through to Canada.
Now, if people are driving around the city, perhaps going onto the freeway off of McKinley, there's a mural into the concrete of Joshua Glover. And I would love for you to share a bit about his story and how that connects to some of our physical history, especially in Cathedral Square.
Yeah, I mean, this is probably the most dramatic story of sanctuary in the 19th century here in Wisconsin. Joshua Glover was a man who was fleeing enslavement in the U.S. South. He made his way through Illinois and came up to Wisconsin. He was captured by these slave capturers that were a big business in the 1850s here in the United States, and he was brought to the Milwaukee Courthouse, which is now, of course, in the Cathedral Square area that we know today. He was being held in captivity there, basically waiting to be taken back to his enslaver. And the community here in Milwaukee, there was a robust abolitionist community here in the city in southeastern Wisconsin, heard about the situation of Joshua Glover, and they quickly went to the Milwaukee County Courthouse. They began by petitioning the local government and the state government to release him, saying that the state of Wisconsin didn't have the institution of slavery on the books, and so this is not something that the U.S. or the state should be abiding by. But of course, the 1850 Fugitive Slave Act mandated that the state of Wisconsin hold Joshua Glover to be taken back to his enslaver. And so this local community of abolitionists decided to take matters into their own hands. At the time, the Cathedral Square was was not known as the Cathedral Square because the St. John's Cathedral had not been built. And it was actually in the process of being built. The timbers were laying out in front of the U.S. courthouse. So these abolitionists actually grabbed the timbers that were being used to build this church to ram down the doors of the courthouse. They grabbed Joshua Glover and they sped him off in the dark of the night, basically moving from safe house to safe house, from Waukesha back to Milwaukee, down to southeastern Wisconsin, before they eventually were able to get him out to Canada where he could be safe. And so there's this really dramatic story that happens here in the heart of our city of abolitionists taking matters into their own hands, recognizing that this law that's on the books, while it may be a question that, you know, is undisputed, this is the law of the land, it was not something that they morally agreed with, and they felt they had to do something about it.
Right. And that kind of shows, not just in this time period, but I feel like throughout history when we're talking about sanctuary, that dynamic and that tension between federal law and local law, and then if you want to get further down to municipal laws, but that contention of, okay, yes, it's federal law technically, but we don't agree.
That's exactly right. And I think we can stretch the question of sanctuary. At its heart has always been this challenge to a form of state power. And what the state is, of course, changes in those conversations. Is it a question of local state? Is it the state, you know, Wisconsin state law, or is it the federal power? And, you know, in this country, we have this rich and robust history of federalism, which is to say there's a distribution of power across the federal level all the way down to the local. And Americans have understood their ability to protest federal law in a lot of different ways. And, you know, oftentimes that is told in a story of the Civil War. We think about how states rejected the federal government, and this led to this great schism that leads to this, you know, this armed struggle. But it's played out in a lot of different ways across American history. And as we know, it continues to play out today, the way in which governors and local elected officials are challenging federal laws that they don't agree with, that their representatives and their constituents don't agree with.
So we're going to bump up to the 1900s here. And a few key parts of our sanctuary history for European immigrants and, of course, the Great Migration in the 40s and 50s. So let's start with the Great Migration. How is this an example of both what you call real and failed sanctuary?
Yeah, I think so. Wisconsin had a late Great Migration, it's often referred to. I think people may know the Great Migration begins really in the early 20th century. But people who are leaving the U.S. South, Black Americans who are either fleeing economic deprivation or they're fleeing the Jim Crow South system that forces them to live in the second-class citizenship, those people start coming northward, and many of them kind of end up in Chicago, so they don't actually make it all the way up to Milwaukee. And our community doesn't really start to grow until the 1940s and 1950s in large numbers, Milwaukee's Black community. And, you know, when they arrive in Milwaukee looking for the exact same things that European immigrants had come to this country looking for in the 1850s, which is a new start and safety. Right? Economic opportunity and not having to look over their shoulder and fearing either, you know, extrajudicial violence or violence by the state. And they arrive here in Milwaukee in the 1940s and 1950s, and sometimes they do find that, right? They certainly do find better economic opportunities here in Milwaukee than they would have found in places like Alabama or Mississippi. But they also find a new system of second-class citizenship. It's not as severe as the Jim Crow South. It's certainly not enacted with the form of violence that lives in places like Alabama or Mississippi. But they know they are made to feel like they don't belong. And that happens in a lot of different ways, whether that's at the work site, whether that's in where they're allowed to live, right? They're tightly constrained within this kind of this few blocks area that we now refer to as the Near North Side. Back then it was known as the urban core. And so Black Americans who arrive here in Milwaukee, who become Black Milwaukeeans and Black Wisconsinites, have to navigate all of these different factors.
And looking at post-World War II as well, especially in relation to European immigrants searching for sanctuary in a time of war, how did we as a nation fail to give safe harbor during the Holocaust specifically?
Yeah, I think most Americans know that the world turned a blind eye to what was happening in Europe, especially Western Europe and in parts of Germany and Austria and Poland throughout the 1930s. And of course, this all becomes extremely apparent after the United States claims victory in Europe in 1945. And you have American soldiers who are going throughout Western Europe and they see concentration camps. And it becomes very clear to Americans who are abroad and eventually as these images make their way across the world that the country had failed to offer sanctuary to not only European Jews, but a wide assortment of people who had been victimized by by the Nazi regime. And so there's an acknowledgement after 1945 that the world needs to do better, right? And so when the United Nations is formed after World War II, one of the, you know, most important things that they do is to establish a set of standards for how the world is responsible to deal with refugees, right? They set up this very clear standard of who is a refugee, and then the obligations or responsibilities of nation states to offer these people a sense of sanctuary, a sense of safe harbor. The entire concept of the refugee is kind of developed as a legal category after 1945. And, you know, after that period, then the United States kind of haphazardly works their way trying to understand what's their obligation to this. The U.S. does not sign on to the U.N. human rights standard of what a refugee is in 1947. In fact, they don't adopt that fully until 1980. And one of the big reasons for that is the United States wants to be able to do their own deciding on what a refugee is and who they're going to bring into the nation. And so after 1945, the Cold War era, the United States continues to kind of work through, you know, who is going to be allowed into this country under this idea of a refugee.
So you mentioned the 1980s, which is perhaps the next biggest and impactful wave of the sanctuary movement. So can you explain why this period is so important when we're talking about sanctuary in modern history?
Yeah, the 1980s is a period where sanctuary becomes a rallying cry for a growing movement of religiously motivated individuals who are working out of houses of worship, who see a growing number of people arriving from Central America, specifically from El Salvador and Guatemala. And these are people who arrive at the U.S.-Mexico border in the early 1980s, bearing very clear marks of the revolutions and the civil wars that they are fleeing, and specifically these repressive regimes that are sending death squads into rural areas, into urban spaces. And so Salvadorans and Guatemalans arrive at the U.S.-Mexico border. They try to avail themselves of the 1980 Refugee Act, which is this new piece of legislation that Congress has passed that has brought the U.S. into line with international human rights law. And that basically stipulates that if a person can demonstrate a well-founded fear of persecution in their home country, they should be allowed to stay in the United States. The problem is that Salvadorans and Guatemalans witness a 97% to 98% rejection rate of their asylum applications. And so you have churches and synagogues in the U.S.-Mexico borderlands. They see this happening. They're asking, why is this going on? And they quickly realize that this is all politically motivated. The Reagan administration is refusing to acknowledge these people as refugees because they would then have to acknowledge the United States' role in destabilizing those countries in the first place. Because at the same time, the U.S. is still sending hundreds of millions of dollars in money, in military support, in training to these countries. And so churches and synagogues decide they have to do something about it. In 1982, in Arizona and California, the first churches declare themselves places of sanctuary for the Central American asylum seekers. And they do so knowing that they might be seen as breaking the law by the federal government. Pretty soon, that movement spreads all across the country, including here in Milwaukee. Milwaukee becomes the host to the first Latino, the first Black, and the first Jewish houses of worship to become sanctuaries for Salvadorans and Guatemalans during this era.
With the spread of the sanctuary movement, as you mentioned, it's made up of many religious organizations as well as individuals. And one person I want to highlight is Sister Darlene Nagorski, who was tried by the Reagan administration. So can you share more about her story? This is around 1985 here.
Yeah, this is kind of one of the points I always emphasize, because Milwaukee was such an important part of the sanctuary movement in the 1980s, both because of the houses of worship here, but also the people that were engaged in the movement. One of the most important, Sister Darlene Nagorski, who was a member of the School Sisters of St. Francis based out of here in Milwaukee. She was Milwaukee born and raised. She had been sent to Guatemala on a mission trip in the late 70s and early 80s. She witnessed some of this destruction that was happening. In fact, the parish priest that she was working with was killed by one of these death squads. She was forced to bring some of her congregants northward into Mexico, into refugee camps. And so she comes back to the United States very much radicalized by what she's seen and very troubled by understanding that her country is responsible for a lot of what's happening in this country. And so she joins the sanctuary movement. She becomes really one of the most important figures in helping people move from the U.S.-Mexico borderlands all across the country. In 1985, the federal government decides to bring charges, federal charges, against some of the leaders of the sanctuary movement. In fact, they had initiated a multi-year campaign where they had been spying on churches. They had been sticking criminal informants inside Bible study meetings, inside the pews of these churches. And they bring these really dramatic charges of human smuggling against the leaders of the movement. And among those who are indicted is Sister Darlene Nagorski. The federal government, the Department of Justice, actually calls her the conductor of the Underground Railroad of the 1980s. And she wears this with a certain badge of pride. And so, in fact, she says when she's interviewed that she is guilty. She's guilty of a conspiracy of love, as she says, which is to say that her faith as a Catholic nun, her status as an American has forced her to do this work, that she has no other, there's no other out for her than to offer a form of safe harbor to Salvadorans and Guatemalans. Ultimately, Sister Darlene, along with those other leaders, are found guilty in a federal court, but they are vindicated in the public eye. In fact, the sanctuary movement is ultimately one of the most successful social movements in the history of the United States. By the end of the 1980s, they successfully sued the federal government to re-adjudicate hundreds of thousands of these asylum applications, and they introduce an entirely new immigration status into American law through the 1990 Immigration Act, which is temporary protected status.
We're kind of talking about push-pull factors here, and one thing that Sister Darlene shows is that church versus state challenge, too. And it's also interesting because we are taught in our typical American history class that America, before it became America, was this Puritan sanctuary. It's the city on a hill. It's where people can come to seek refuge, you know, as we're at the whole concepts that we're talking about here. But this church versus state thing is very interesting with how religion is kind of tied into this American view of ourselves, right?
Yeah, and I think, and I'll add another layer here, which is that in the 1980s, most Americans think of the 1980s. When they think about religion, they think of the religious right. They think of figures like Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell, and they don't think about a different strain of religiosity, which is one that is trying to bridge these spaces into open doors as opposed to close them. And so in the 1980s, you have these people of faith, whether they're Christian, they're Jewish, who are thinking capaciously. They're thinking broadly about what their faith requires them to do. And so, you know, for both Christians and Jews who joined the sanctuary in the 1980s, they refer back to the Old Testament. The Old Testament has one commandment to love your God, but more than 36 injunctions to welcome the stranger, right? It's a clear demand of the faith, which is to say that if there's someone who arrives at your door and asks for reprieve, they ask for safe harbor, you have an obligation as a person of faith to welcome them in. And so when people of faith see what's happening, they acknowledge that they perhaps might be breaking the law, right? But they also believe that the United States is responsible for breaking a series of laws. One, they're not following the 1980 Refugee Act, which clearly mandates who is allowed to have refuge and asylum in this country. And two, they say, regardless of what the law says, there is a moral law they have to follow. When these people are being persecuted, when they're being deported and sent back to a country where they might be facing death, what is our obligations, not only as Americans, but as people of faith?
Now, with regard to being dissatisfied with what the federal level is doing, to localize another example here, in 1986, Wisconsin Governor Tony Earle declared Wisconsin as a sanctuary state. So what does that actually mean, and how does that also give another example of that state versus federal tension that plays out?
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of listeners would be surprised to learn that Wisconsin has been a sanctuary state since the 1980s. But of course, Governor Earle is aware of what's happening, of course, right? All Americans see what's happening here, especially when these federal charges are brought against these sanctuary workers. It becomes national news. And Governor Earle feels an obligation as an elected official here in the state to recommend that Wisconsinites get involved in this work, right? He also believes that the Reagan administration is in the wrong for sending hundreds of millions of dollars to Central America. He also believes that the Reagan administration is not fulfilling its legal obligation to offer these people asylum in this country under the 1980 Refugee Act. So in 1986, as Sister Darlene is going through these court cases, as the sanctuary movement is on trial, Governor Earle, in the middle of the campaign season, right, re-election, and he decides to declare Wisconsin a sanctuary state. Now, on paper, what it means, it's mostly a statement of support for the movement. And in fact, he invites Wisconsinites to join this work as well. He doesn't have the clear statements there what it actually means for state employees or, you know, if there's going to be financial contributions to this effort, which that never actually materializes. But it sends a clear statement on where he believes the state of Wisconsin should be and where Wisconsinites should stand on the question of sanctuary.
Gotcha. So our next kind of marker of sanctuary and the movement and higher activity of this movement is under former President George W. Bush's administration. And this is specifically post 9/11. So can you explain how this event kind of restarted the movement in a more public facing way?
Yeah, the movement goes dormant after the early 1990s. The revolutions in Central America settle down. The U.S. begins to actually live up to its obligations under the Refugee Act. And so through much of the 90s, sanctuary doesn't really come into motion. It's really after 9/11 when the United States begins to ramp up its surveillance of undocumented communities. And there are growing calls to really connect questions of national security and national defense with immigration, which leads to militarization of the border, the creation of organizations like Immigration Customs Enforcement or ICE. And so there are more and more undocumented people in this country who feel unsafe. They feel like they can't come out of the shadows, as is often referred to. They feel like they can't live their lives in this country. And so as there's a rising number of deportations, first under George W. Bush and then especially under President Barack Obama, houses of worship again jump into this work. There's a revival of sanctuary. In fact, the movement is reborn in about 2011, 2013 is when you start to see these really large growing numbers of churches and synagogues get involved. They call themselves the New Sanctuary Movement. And now they're offering safe harbor not just to asylum seekers, but also to people who have lived in this country for 20 years, right? People from Mexico, from Guatemala, from Ecuador, from all parts of the world, in fact, who perhaps see themselves as Americans in all ways except for their legal documentation. They've established roots here. They have jobs here. They've had children here. And now they're fearing that they're going to be torn away from the very social fabric that makes them feel at home in this country. And so the New Sanctuary Movement kind of takes up that 100-year history of sanctuary in this country, 150-year-plus history of sanctuary in this country, repackages it and becomes another vibrant movement, especially under the administrations of George W. Bush and Barack Obama.
Right. And to remind people, one of Barack Obama's nicknames was Deporter-in-Chief. So, you know, when it comes to having selective memory or being really involved in what's happening in the now, which, of course, is a natural human response, as you've said and told me, it's one of my favorite phrases, like, nothing is unprecedented, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think I always remind my students that there's not much that's bipartisan in the history of this country, but when it comes to immigration enforcement, Democrats and Republicans have both played a very important role and created what the historian Adam Goodman refers to as the deportation machine. And so where we find ourselves today is really the consequence of course, of decades of history and of immigration enforcement.
So as you say, with the New Sanctuary Movement from George W. Bush up until today, and also with Trump's previous presidency, it's this kind of retaliation against the sanctuary movement being more broad, more encompassing. What are some of the anti-sanctuary things that are happening, whether it's on the federal level or just in public opinion?
Yeah, I think we have seen, of course, I always say that to talk about immigration politics in 2025 is to talk about anti-sanctuary politics. And the reason that is because sanctuary has served as such a robust form of rebuke to the federal government, whether it's in the 1980s, whether it's in that initiation of the New Sanctuary Movement, or specifically in the first election of Donald Trump in 2016. In 2017, we saw this kind of prairie fire spreading across the country, right? It was sanctuary kind of growing, not just in religious spaces, but also in secular spaces. So the growth of sanctuary cities and sanctuary states, as local municipalities made the decision to tell public employees to not participate in immigration enforcement, we saw things like the growth of sanctuary school districts and sanctuary campuses, heck, even things like sanctuary restaurants, right? And much of this was often a form of messaging to say that this is a place where we welcome immigrants regardless of their immigration status. But sometimes these actions actually had teeth, right? Which is to say that they actually served as a barrier for the federal government to enact some of the most punitive forms of immigration enforcement. So if it's an effective form of rebuke to the federal government, we might expect there to be a counter movement towards that. And of course, in the last 10 years, we have seen the growth of these anti-sanctuary politics. In fact, Donald Trump in his second election here made sanctuary one of the cornerstones of his work, right? He has gone just very, very hard against sanctuary cities during his first term and in his second term. Within the first few hours of assuming power in the Oval Office, he signed executive orders in both terms against sanctuary cities, right? Trying to bring to heel these elected officials to force them to accommodate his immigration enforcement standards. And so it is kind of the history of social movements in this country, which is to say that if there's an effective social movement, there is going to be an effective counter movement towards it as well. We are right now kind of living through the consequences of that. It is much too soon to tell what will be the outcome of this. We do know that across the federal government, whether it's at the executive branch or at the legislative branch, anti-sanctuary politics are gaining quite a purchase right now.
So with Wisconsin being a sanctuary state in the 1980s, But yet today, if we want to localize it even more, here in Milwaukee, we're not a sanctuary city, but our sister city like Chicago is. So what do you think it means today to be in a city that's not a sanctuary city, but yet have all of this happening around us, having it affect our communities that live here? What's your stance on where we go or what you think is the right move to make locally?
Yeah, I think the fact that we see such a varied response to the question of sanctuary across the United States, I think speaks to its power, right? So you have some mayors across the United States that have decided to walk away from that term and who see that as a, you know, politically odious term. In fact, they say that it's going to bring a spotlight onto the municipality, and it's going to also bring the consequences that come from it. In other words, President Trump might decide to pull funding from those places, or at least threaten to do so. And that's been the case here in Milwaukee. The mayor here in Milwaukee has decided to pretty actively walk away from that term, even if some of the policies remain in place, which is to say that City of Milwaukee employees don't engage in immigration enforcement. I mean, this has been the policy for quite some years now, but you're not going to see many elected officials in the City of Milwaukee use that term. Now, it's different from a place like Boston or Chicago, where the mayors there in both of those cities proudly use that term. They see it not only as a way to continue the lineage of the sanctuary work, but they know that empowers communities that are afraid, right? Those people who are afraid that ICE is going to be roaming the streets and perhaps that their local sheriff or their local police captain is going to be asking their officers to engage in that work as well, right? So when a local mayor says, we're not going to do that, and in fact, we're going to continue this long history of sanctuary work, they're making a statement, not just to the federal government, but to the local constituents as well. We know here in Wisconsin that Governor Evers has now been kind of pulled into this space as well. He issued some very clear standards on what state employees are supposed to do when it comes to sharing information, and none of this was radical activism. In fact, it's pretty much what most school districts already do. It's what a lot of local municipalities do. You know, most state offices don't have the resources to engage in immigration enforcement to begin with, much less the safety questions that come along with it. And yet, just by dipping his toe into these questions, he has become a national figure. And you have someone like Tom Homan, who is President Trump's quote-unquote border czar, who has functionally threatened to jail Governor Evers, right, to pull him into this debate as well. And so even for those elected officials who refuse to use the word sanctuary, they can't run away from it. I mean, the politics and the actions are what really matter here. Most importantly, what are the ways that you're going to show up for an immigrant community?
Well, Sergio, I want to thank you so much for joining me to take a little historical deep dive into sanctuary. It's an important movement, and it's really interesting to dive into how it's changed over time.
Thanks for having me.
Sergio Gonzalez is an assistant professor of history at Marquette University and the author of the books Strangers No Longer, Latino Belonging and Faith in 20th Century Wisconsin, and Mexicans in Wisconsin. He joined me as a part of WUWM's series, Making Wisconsin Our Immigration History. You can listen to our full conversation at WUWM.com, and be sure to tune into Lake Effect every day this week for more on local immigration history.
You can find more interviews like this one by visiting WUWM.com/Lake Effect. And while you're there, subscribe to the Lake Effect Spotlight podcast.